From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with artist Keith Haring. He started off doing graffiti in the New York City subway stations. Now his paintings, murals, and sculptures can be seen around the world. Also today, I talk with Alex Trebek, the man with all the answers on the TV game show Jeopardy. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Bad, the new album from Michael Jackson, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Hamburger Hill, a soldier's eye view of the Vietnam War. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is artist Keith Haring. He is now paid tens of thousands of dollars to do the kind of work he used to get arrested for. Haring's early work took its cue from New York City subway graffiti. He made the rounds of subway stations doing quick chalk sketches on train station walls. The designs were cartoon-like human figures, barking dogs, hearts, crawling babies. Rush Hour provided a bigger audience for his work than any gallery or museum could. Word spread, and Haring became an important part of the East Village art scene. His work was shown in galleries, and its value began to rise. He became something of an art superstar, but he continued to insist that his work have a life outside of the art world. He painted colorful murals on walls and buildings, created public sculpture, and decorated rock clubs. Last year, he opened his pop shop, where he sells items like T-shirts, radios, and refrigerator magnets, imprinted with his colorful, cartoon-like designs. Keith Haring is in Philadelphia today, working with teenagers on a neighborhood wall mural. I spoke with him yesterday, and he told me what it was about graffiti that excited him when he moved to New York City.
Well, first of all, I got there in 78, which was really prime time for this subways being painted in New York. A lot of that has since changed, but for me, coming from growing up in a small town in Pennsylvania, first of all, and then living in Pittsburgh for a short period, and coming to New York, one of the reasons I came to New York was to look for my peers, sort of, or find other people that were working with a similar intensity and coming from the same generation, because I wasn't really finding that where I was in Pittsburgh, and I wasn't around people that really, inspiring me or making, challenging me to make me do more things. And immediately after coming to New York, although I was going to galleries and seeing other things also, one of the things that struck me most was the work in the subway. Because at that time, like I said, trains were really, almost every train was painted, and they were really beautiful.
Like murals on the sides of whole train cars.
Yeah, like the entire car is usually sometimes inside and out. And it was in a way very pop. I mean, the characters using colors and cartoon characters, which had come out of, I think, the whole generation of people that were growing up with really good cartoons on television and really good sort of pop culture.
So you wanted to do something that was your version of that kind of expression?
Well, I think, for the first 2 years, I didn't do anything on the street. I mean, I was sort of watching and appreciating it, but my thing that I wanted to not do was to sort of jump on the bandwagon and copy their style or do something that looked as if it was just an imitation or something of what I was seeing on the trains. So the first time that I did something in the street was really only when I had discovered something that I thought made sense to be on the street. Although I had a lot of things in common with these graffiti things, because my whole background had really been in cartooning, and so my concept and sense of the line and of the scale that I was seeing there and of the sense of color, etc., was very much in tune with them, but there was also something that was distinctly different in the kind of drawings that I was starting to do. And it was really only when I started drawing these sort of images, which in the beginning were just human images and animals and spaceships and pyramids and things in different combinations and juxtapositions. It was only then that I really had something to put on the subway, because before that I had been doing only abstract drawings, sort of, doing I guess, pseudo-abstract expressionist or sort of gestural abstract drawings, which didn't make sense to me to be on the street. But as soon as I had this vocabulary kind of images, it almost necessitated that it should be on the street.
One of the things you were doing was drawing in subway stations.
That started after I had come up with these characters, and then by accident sort of discovered that there were all these empty panels in the subway inside the station where they usually have advertisements. When they don't have enough ads, they cover the space with empty black paper to cancel out the old ad. And although they had probably been there for years, one day I felt like I had discovered it, because I had never seen anyone draw on it before. And it immediately seemed like the perfect place to draw. First of all, because I could draw very quickly, because these things I was drawing were very simple and very, very quick sort of, line drawings. And also because it was a very borderline case between being legal and illegal, because it wasn't right on the wall, and because I was drawing with chalk, it was sort of a delicate sort of situation when I would get caught, because it was hard to really say that you were defacing, because you were drawing with chalk, and also you were drawing on a paper panel that would inevitably be changed and replaced within a week or 2 weeks.
What was your plan when you started doing this? Did you figure out which subway stations to hit and have an organized scheme for covering the city?
It really didn't start with a plan. I mean, it started almost, like I said, by accident. And in the beginning, was something I did on my way to work when I'd be riding the trains, and was more a hobby in the beginning. After about a month or two, and the increased sort of interest in it and the response I was getting from passerbys, etc., I started to do it more as a full-time thing, and after a period of a year, it became almost like a science. I mean, I drew in the subway from 1980 to 1985, and after the first year or two, I was so well organized with it that I would know when to do a line and what time of day to do it, and sort of how quickly to do it and how to avoid, getting caught by cops, etc. And also had undertaken having them photographed systematically. Like I had a friend who named Sang Kwang Chi, who was a photographer, who would, after I would do a route, I would usually do two or three routes a week, but after I'd do a route, I'd call him up and tell him which lines, which stations I would do, and he'd go out and systematically photograph as many of them as he could. So over 5 years, we've accumulated thousands of photographs of these different drawings.
Artist Keith Haring is my guest. Did it get to the point where graffiti writers started noticing your stuff and try to find you?
That happened really right away. Because one of the things for me to start was that I was almost more concerned about getting the approval or respect of the other graffiti writers than I was of the people in the art world or the, other writers of the subway, because to me the biggest challenge was to do what I was doing in a way that it would not be looked at as something that was fake or was a copy or was outside of what they were doing. And so to me it was very important to win the respect of other graffiti artists in the way that I did it, and the similar attitude and the way that I approached it and the ways I would and would not draw, etc. So that was, it was something that was really important to me, and it also has been a kind of a lasting thing. I mean, I still, through all the things that have happened since then, and even after now I've stopped drawing in the subway, but I still have probably more respect from so-called graffiti writers than I do from other fellow artists that I was sort of emerging from at that same time.
You were fined several times by the police, and I think arrested once?
I was arrested several times and fined several times. But in those cases, a lot of times it would start out being a little bit scary, but it would end up being a really amusing situation, because the cop who caught me usually didn't know who I was, but when he would take me to the station, a lot of times would find out that other policemen in the station were eager to find out who this person was, because after a year or two, everyone that rode the subways knew the drawings, you know, because if you rode the subway, and you know, even just once a week, you'd see at, you know, several drawings, and this went on for a 5-year period. So I had a large following of people in the subway, many of which were policemen that spent their time in the subway, that were very eager to find out who I was. I had a great, actually, one of my favorite stories was coming out of a restaurant with Andy Warhol when we were eating, and a cop came up to him and wanted his autograph. And Andy was always, the first thing Andy would always do is introduce the other people. He was always sort of playing down his own importance and saying, you know, well, you have to, here, you should get his autograph because he's a famous graffiti artist. And the cop said, really? And he started, the cop was in uniform. He started taking out his ticket book. And so I sort of looked at Andy like, well, he's, you know, he can't give me a ticket now for something I did before. And he opened the ticket book, and on the inside of the ticket book was a sticker with my Radiant Baby thing on it. So it was sort of, you know, it sort of turns up in funny places. You know, so I actually had a lot of cops that were fans at the same time.
You know, one thing that I think some people have wondered is, you've done graffiti and become really famous for that and for your subsequent work. Some people feel that somehow you had the advantage over graffiti writers because you were a white, middle-class, art-trained person. Mm. I don't know, how do you feel when people say that about you in a critical way?
People have a lot of misguided ideas about graffiti, first of all. First of all, just the definition of graffiti, but about what you're talking about, a lot of people, first of all, assume that only black and Hispanic kids do graffiti, which is completely not true, and the kids that do graffiti only come from poor neighborhoods, etc. I mean, a lot of the best graffiti writers in New York were from white middle class or upper class families. It had nothing to do necessarily with what background you came from. And also for me, there's of course some truth in that matter, that when I would get caught, it was definitely to my advantage that I looked like I had glasses and I was a white boy and didn't look like someone that was going to cause trouble, etc. So I could sort of take that and use it to my advantage. I mean, there are people like Michael Stewart who got beat to death by police because, not because he was writing graffiti, but because he was black. I've had cops say very racist things to me, say like you should be glad you're white, or we'd be blah blah blah. You know, most black and Puerto Rican kids that I know that have gotten caught, even kids, some kids that were drawing with chalk on the panels, have gotten beaten up. I mean, it is very common that the first thing they do is they beat you up and then ask questions. So I definitely used the situation to my advantage, but I don't think that was wrong. I mean, I was as aware of the situation as anyone else, but I don't think that, I don't know, I think that everyone has sort of an equal opportunity to do things with, what if, you know, if I had done the kind of drawings I was doing and had done it in the way I was doing it, it wouldn't have mattered what color I was necessarily. When I did things out of the thing that made my work, I guess, more universal or on another level was not the fact that it was graffiti. Graffiti played, in reality, a very small role in the overall picture of my work. The graffiti was one way that I got it out to a group of people. But the fact that it was graffiti isn't what made my work popular or made me famous. The work itself is the only thing that had that power. So it was really the drawing itself, not where the drawing was done, that was the power of the work.
You stopped working on the subways in 1985. Briefly, why did you give that up?
Well, first of all, 85, if you look at the things that were happening to me in my quote-unquote career, 85 was very late to have given that up. I mean, I could have easily stopped in 82, and because by that point I was already making a living from the paintings, etc., that I was doing. So for me to continue to even to 85 was sort of past the point when I really had to, for if I was only seeking fame and attention. And in a way, it is one of the things that I miss the most, because it was a very direct and very, very real thing, sort of very real connection with people and a very, very sort of genuine kind of art experience that you would have with
all totally kinds of people. It's totally outside of the gallery and museum.
Yeah. But it became, first of all, by 1985, I was starting to not only deal with New York City, but try to deal with the whole world, which meant that I had to spend time in a lot of other countries. And my just physically, there was not time to be in the subway in New York because I wasn't in New York. Also, people by that time were very aware of how much the drawings were worth, whether they were on chalk and in the subway or not. If you could peel a drawing off, you could resell it for a few thousand dollars. So this became more and more of a popular thing for people to come in and remove them with a putty knife. And for me, that was sort of not, it was reaching the whole, you know, it was the wrong point. It wasn't what I was doing them for. And it became necessary to start to do the public things on permanent surfaces that couldn't be removed, like the building I'm doing here on concrete, you know.
Artist Keith Haring is my guest, and he started working in the New York City subways, but his work has branched out to museum galleries, amusement parks around the world. We'll talk more about his recent work after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
I'm speaking with artist Keith Haring. One of the projects you've taken on in the past year is a store in which you sell T-shirts and buttons and other items with
toys,
your
coloring books, posters, etc.
With your designs on them.
Yeah.
And even the walls of the store are painted
right
by you in your designs. And this has been very controversial in the art world. Some people think it's really exciting to get your work out on common objects like T-shirts. And other people think it's a sign that you've really sold out and made your art into the equivalent of designer jeans.
Yes. In a way, the Pop Shop is probably the best way to explain maybe the overall idea of how this whole sort of other venture into the real world, how it came about or why it's important to me. For me, it was not something that was a matter of choice. If I was being honest to myself and, more importantly, honest to the work itself, to the drawings, and to even down to the way the line itself, the kind of line, the kind of image that I was creating, then the Pop Shop grew out of something that for me was inevitable. The same way that when the drawings of these images, which were about communicating information and ideas, existed, and then because they existed, they, by almost by the nature of themselves, they demanded to be in public, which made them be in the subway. In the same way, once they were in the subway and had effectively started to communicate and become part of the consciousness of not only New York City, but then through magazines and video and television to the world, it also necessitated that I continue with that idea and pursue it in a way that was honest to myself and to that thing, in that definitely I could have, and very easily, I guess, hidden within the safety of the art world and stayed in my studio and produced paintings, and which sell on the art market for very inflated prices, because that's what the art market is about. That's a whole other question. But the for me, it was inside the work itself that it was not owned by me. It was bigger than me, and it was something that should be part of the whole world. And the only way to really make that happen was to do things first of all, things through commercial publication, meaning sometimes album covers or advertising and magazines, and then but also to make things on things which people could have, so that people could have a piece of this whole thing.
So you don't see it as commercializing your art, you see it as making your art accessible to people who don't have the money to buy
Well, I mean, I can't, of course, cannot deny that it is not commercializing it, because that, I mean, that's the way the world works. I mean, you can't, it's impossible to give away things to everyone, right? I mean, I have spent a lot of time doing giveaway things also. I mean, printing posters and giving them away for free at rallies, anti-nuclear things or Free South Africa, etc., or giving away badges and little things like that. But on a, to really get it and make some real impact into other people's minds and the world, etc., and culture, the only way to really have any effect on that was to work within that system. I mean, you can't really be outside of a system and criticize it or comment on it and change it or have any impact without being inside of it and sort of working through the same mechanics of that system.
You were good friends with the late Andy Warhol, and he was really the master of mass-produced art. Did you get any advice from him on the kind of undertaking that you've done with the Pop Shop?
Advice on
merchandising your art or on mass producing it?
Not necessarily specific things, but Andy was always full of encouragement. Actually, we discussed lots of ideas, but discussed almost everything, I guess. I mean, because we'd talk about different things, but Andy was. Would generally support almost anything that you said, so it was sort of hard to get really a critical answer out of him. But more than by conversation, I learned a lot of things from Andy just by watching and by example. I mean, Andy was one of the best sort of teachers of people just by what he was saying one sentence or just by example. He was a kind of incredible philosopher that a lot of people looked up to and learned things from. At the same time, watching the way that the art world, the quote-unquote established art world and art market, treated Andy, I also learned a lot of things about the risks and the dangers of doing that. But for me, anything worth doing is worth taking a risk. I mean, if you look at a painting of Andy Warhol's now, even after his death, aside of a painting by Jasper Johns or something like that, the prices are they have nothing to do with each other. But for me, the value of something cannot be determined by something like the art market or the art world. And the value of Warhol is tenfold greater than Jasper Johns ever will be. The amount of people and the amount of effect that he has had on the culture and the world and thinking is incredible.
You've become one of the celebrities of the art world, and I wonder if that's a mixed blessing for you, and if some people love you for it and other people hate you for the status you've achieved.
Of course. I mean, I think everything is a mixed blessing in a way, but especially when you get picked out of a group of people that are sort of singled out, yours are going to have to deal with that being scrutinized and being picked apart sort of for every little thing that you do. I think for me it was a blessing because it was part of the idea of what I was trying to do. I mean, to really be effective as an artist, and all of a sudden to have this outlet where I have access to all kinds of avenues of communication, from television to computers to magazines, etc. It was, you know, for me it was great, because in a way that I was hoping to be creating something that was beyond the traditional idea of what an artist does.
When you're famous and when you have a talent, many people want a piece of it. And I know you get offers from around the world for commissions, for designs, for everything from tote bags to buildings, probably. And you're in the position of having to decide what's worth your time and what you're interested in and what isn't worth your time and you're not interested in. Do you have any standard that you could communicate, or is it a case-by-case thing?
It's pretty much case-by-case, but for me, it's interesting that it has become almost a part of my art. I mean, it becomes an aesthetic decision and an overall decision, everything that you decide. I mean, I spend most of my time deciding what not to do, because in a lot of people's eyes, especially the people that have been critical and will say things like that I sold out, etc., if they had any idea of the kinds of things that I could have done and the kinds of things that I have turned down, and many of which for large sums of money, they would have a complete different understanding. And that's why in time, I think when people understand the broader picture of what kinds of possibilities there were, the way that I could have existed in the world and the choices that I made, everything has been a very careful decision. And I mean, half of the things, maybe not half, but at least a third of the things I do for no money at all.
I guess one of the things that probably surprised a lot of people was the vodka ad that you did the illustration for.
Well, actually, it's funny because that's the only commercial thing that I've done in the United States. I've done things in Europe and in Japan, more things in all over Europe, and select things. I mean, something for Rank Xerox and things for different things. But the vodka ad I actually got into because of Andy. Andy had done the ad for Absolut Vodka last year, and Andy actually suggested the idea to me and asked me if I wanted to do it. And
Andy
for
Warhol.
Me, the fact that Andy had done it first had totally okayed it for me. Although there are things that Andy also did that I wouldn't do after him, but the people that were doing the vodka ad were very they were sort of genuine about it and were very clean. One interesting thing, which actually I just happened to me last week, found out that I was talking to a friend that's in jail in Rikers Island, and it was telling me that that he had my Absolut Vodka ad up on his wall in the cell, right? And all of a sudden it dawned on me that anything anyone negative could say about me was totally washed away just by that, because the fact that that was maybe the only way that my art could have gotten into inside of a prison or places where people are really have no other access to any kind of thing, but that he could have taken it out and put it on his wall and it was still art. I mean, it was, and so, you know, it was totally effective, even if it only got to that one person.
We only have about a minute left, so I'm going to ask you this briefly. You're in Philadelphia now, painting a mural in one of the neighborhoods, on a wall.
Yeah, the side of a building.
Side of a building. Now you've done a lot of murals on walls of handball courts, on sides of buildings in New York and in other cities. Before you go in and do a mural in a community, do you feel out the community first or not? Do you want to have a sense of approval before you go in and paint it?
In New York City, definitely. Because I'm not from Philadelphia, I didn't have the opportunity to do that, but I let it in the hands of people here from Brandywine Workshop who have done many murals in Philadelphia. The only request that I had when I talked to people here was that I did not want to do it in a shopping area or inside a mall kind of thing. I wanted to do it in a real neighborhood, preferably in a schoolyard or hospital, something like that, or in a neighborhood that was really a neighborhood where real people lived and where they needed something better, you know, instead of something that was in the middle of a shopping area where it would just, you know, make a nice area even nicer. Because I think the most important place to put things, especially when they're volunteer things, is places that really need them. So I have done a lot of hospitals and a lot of areas in New York, mostly funky areas, I guess.
Okay, well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work. Thanks for being here. My guest has been artist Keith Haring. His colorful cartoon-like designs can be seen on walls, T-shirts, buttons, and canvases around the world. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Alan Brandt. He's studied the social history of sexually transmitted diseases, including AIDS. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, the TV quizmaster who says it breaks his heart when contestants blow the answer. Who is Alex Trebek? Michael Jackson is back with a follow-up to his phenomenally successful Thriller album. It's called Bad. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new Vietnam movie, Hamburger Hill. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green in Washington. The Reagan administration today declared support for a peace mission to Iran next week by U.N. Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. State Department spokesman Charles Redman also announced a delay in drafting Security Council sanctions against Iran. The U.S. had originally given Tehran until tomorrow to accept a U.N. ceasefire resolution or face a possible U.N. call for an arms embargo. The administration action came amid reports of the most violent 24-hour period since the Persian Gulf tanker war reopened last week. We get details from NPR's Deborah Amos in Dubai.
Iraq said it hit a large naval target off the coast of Iran this morning. It's the 12th attack on ships bound for Iran this week. Earlier this morning, an armed Iranian speedboat manned by Revolutionary Guards sprayed an Italian cargo ship with rockets. One crewman was injured. The captain broke his leg while falling down some stairs, trying to get out of the range of the shots. One sailor on board who watched the speedboat approach said they just fired for the fun of killing people. Yesterday, Iraqi jets attacked a small supply ship called the Big Orange. The supply ship was sailing near Iran's Karg Island. The ship is owned by an American company based in Houston that helps Iran export oil. Two crewmen were killed. One man on board said it takes a peculiar kind of inhuman being to launch an attack on a defenseless ship. Meanwhile, three U.S.-flagged Kuwaiti tankers are sailing south in the Gulf, escorted by American warships. In Dubai, this is Deborah Amos.
The independent prosecutor in the Iran-Contra affair says he's likely to question President Reagan as part of his inquiry into the scandal. But Lawrence Walsh said today his investigators will first polish their questions so as not to waste the president's time. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden today released a report critical of Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork. The 72-page analysis contradicts a White House paper on Bork, which characterizes the nominee as a moderate. Biden's survey says that contrary to administration claims, Bork is actually a judicial activist determined to advance President Reagan's conservative political agenda. In a Moscow courtroom today, a Soviet prosecutor recommended a near-maximum sentence for the young West German who piloted his plane to Red Square in May. If the Soviet judge accepts the prosecutor's arguments, Matthias Rust could face 8 years in a Soviet labor camp. More from Jeremy Harris.
The prosecution spent most of the second day of the trial depicting the flight of Matthias Rust as less an idealistic peace mission, the young West German's own version, than a highly dangerous joyride. In his evidence yesterday, Matthias Rust said he deliberately touched down away from Red Square because it was too crowded. Today, he denied claims that he'd told bystanders on landing that the flight had been for fun. However, the prosecution produced a string of eyewitnesses to support claims that both people and property had been put seriously at risk. One said his first impulse on seeing the plane over Red Square had been to duck. In a sternly worded summing up, the state prosecutor said that although the young West German was less than 20, he knew that he'd risked his own life and the lives of others. Matthias Rust, he added, was a hooligan.
The BBC's Jeremy Harris in Moscow. The judge is expected to pronounce sentence tomorrow. In a miracle of tenacity, the pilot of an Eastern Express commuter plane survived being sucked out of his aircraft last night during a flight from Lewiston, Maine to Boston. Henry Dempsey clung to the open door, dangling outside the plane for 10 minutes, while his co-pilot made an emergency landing at Portland International Airport. Dempsey suffered only cuts and bruises from his terrifying ordeal. Federal aviation officials are investigating. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 2 points to close at 2599.49. Declines led advances 3-2 on volume of 165 million shares. I'm Sharon Green, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. A few days ago, Michael Jackson fans got a look at his new video on TV. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Jackson's new album.
In what is possibly the biggest anti-climax in the history of popular music, Michael Jackson released a new album earlier this week. It's the follow-up to Thriller, the 1982 album that sold 38 gazillion copies and made Jackson America's most easily recognized eccentric. It's Michael Jackson's attempt to overcome the curse of being a superstar in an era that eats up superstars and then spits them out. The album is called Bad, and it's good. That's the title song from Bad, and it's typical of the rough, upbeat music that dominates the album. This is the best thing about Bad. Jackson has denied his soppy, sentimental side. In lots of ways, I think, Michael Jackson is much like another superstar recently in the news, Elvis Presley, who, 10 years after his death, still seems an impossible combination of ferocious rock and roll and hideous junk. Just as Presley's smartest fans never wanted to admit that their hero liked Dean Martin as much as he did gospel music, so do many of Michael Jackson's admirers wish he'd stop being influenced by pals such as Liza Minnelli. It's clear from Bad that, after the drubbing he's taken in the press as a flighty oddball, Jackson wants to prove that he's living in the real world. That's what leads to songs like Dirty Diana, which is essentially a safe sex, pro-monogamy pitch couched in sensuous rock and roll.
Yeah. That song, Dirty Diana, employs the guitar playing of Steve Stevens for the same reason Eddie Van Halen was used on Thriller's Beat It, to give the music a hard rock edge, to goose it onto rock radio stations that resist playing black artists. But I think this new song shows an evolution in this strategy. Where Van Halen's solo was plopped into the middle of Beat It, Steve Stevens' guitar is integrated into the body of Dirty Diana. As a result, the composition is a more unified piece of work. There's almost no chance that Bad will sell as many records as Thriller did, or that Michael Jackson will once again dominate the media the way he did 4 or 5 years ago. That sort of mass pop phenomenon just doesn't happen twice in one performer's career. But on Bad, Michael Jackson acquits himself better than many of us thought he ever would. His public persona may be built around the fact that he's a weirdo, but the music on this album confirms once again that he's a talented weirdo.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Alex Trebek. He hosts the TV game show Jeopardy. It's the one that viewers think of as something between a trivia quiz and an IQ test. Each night, contestants try to earn prize money by answering questions in 6 categories.
May I have authors for $200, please?
Certainly. The first clue is, in the 1950s, he published Brave New World Revisited, a supplement to his 1932 work. Joe.
Who is Aldous Huxley?
You are right.
Cards for $200.
The high card in a royal flush poker hand. Lee.
What is the ace?
Right.
Thank you, Alex. I'll start with M for $200, please.
The answer. Meaning belonging to the muses. It's a picture made of colored tiles set in mortar. Joe.
What is a mosaic?
Right.
Starts with M for $400.
The answer there is an Audio Daily Double.
Maybe a lot of viewers already know the answer to this, but I don't. What's the rationale for having to give the answer in the form of a question?
Basically, it's a gimmick, but it is the gimmick that makes Jeopardy unique among quiz programs. It adds one step to a mental process that is already very difficult for our contestants. And it happens to be the way that Merv Griffin invented the game.
I've seen times when a contestant has lost money because instead of saying, "What is the Brooklyn Bridge, Alex?" they say, "The Brooklyn Bridge." Does it make you feel bad when you have to disqualify an answer because it wasn't asked in the form of a question?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not a mean person. I'm there to see that the contestants do as well as they possibly can within the context of the rules. Now, we are lenient to a certain extent. In the Jeopardy round, the first round of play, we always remind the contestants about their phrasing. We do not do that in Double Jeopardy. We do not do that in Final Jeopardy. And we do not do that for any of the daily doubles. If they make a mistake in those 3 instances, unfortunately, it is going to cost them. And it cost one of our players in last year's Tournament of Champions very dearly. He got the correct response, but he didn't put it in the form of a question. I was heartbroken for him. I had tears in my eyes. He took it a lot better than I did. So, yes, it does upset us when that kind of thing happens. And as a result, we have contestant coordinators working with the players through all the commercial breaks, constantly reminding them, remember, phrase it in the form of a question, especially on Final Jeopardy.
How do they come up with the questions for Jeopardy?
We've got a staff of 12 writer-researchers who find material everywhere. encyclopedias, magazines, newspapers, television programs, daily experiences, you name it. When I travel, I will come back with suggestions for the writing staff saying, hey, I was in Colorado Springs and I visited NORAD and I went to the Air Force Academy and the Air Force Academy Chapel is the most visited tourist site, man-made tourist site in the state of Colorado. So they'll write that up and it winds up being a clue on Jeopardy.
Do you guys ever make mistakes in what you think the correct answer is and have to correct it after the commercial?
Usually our facts are correct, but they may be incomplete. A contestant who knows a great deal about a particular subject may be able to enlighten us and say, hey, this really is right. I'm a nuclear physicist, and your question had to do with nuclear physics, and none of your writer researchers are experts in this field, and I am. And if you look in such and such a book, you'll find that my response is acceptable. And we'll do that, and we'll make a correction.
I don't know what your role is in choosing the contestants, or are you involved in that process?
No. I was producer of Jeopardy for the first three seasons. I'm not anymore since I started hosting Concentration. And the networks are very sensitive to the old scandal problem that gave them a great deal of concern in the 1950s. And so what they like to have is a separation of powers or a separation of personnel, if you will, between the contestant area and the material preparation area. And because I was producer and was overseeing everything, I made a decision on my own to stay out of the contestant selection process entirely.
It sounds like it's quite an elaborate process. Contestants have to take tests and then do sample shows before you pass them and make them an official contestant.
Absolutely. It's probably the most difficult test of any show on the air right now. And in fact, I think it's more difficult than being on the show. And it has to be. We want our contestants to have a broad-based knowledge. We want them to be able to recall information quickly and accurately. We want them to be able to play the game well, and we also would like them to have some measure of personality.
For a lot of people, I think getting on a game show is a peak experience. You're not only on TV, but you're also able to make a lot of money while you're on TV, bringing together two of the great American dreams. And people would be so nervous in that moment that I'd imagine a lot of people freeze once the cameras turn on. Does that
not
happen
really
a lot? Really? They're
no,
that well prepared, huh?
It doesn't really happen on Jeopardy, and I'll tell you why. Most game shows or quiz shows are taped five programs in one day. So you need a whole week's supply of contestants on that particular day. They've already had a rehearsal game prior to this, so they've gotten kind of comfortable with the television lights, with the camera, the music, and all of the activity that's going on in the studio. And in addition, the people who are upcoming contestants are sitting in the audience and are playing the game. They're saying, oh boy, and you always play it a lot better when you're not involved in it. I'm sure you've heard the comment from your friends who might be Jeopardy fans. They say, gosh, I sit at home in my living room and I get everything right. Well, that's true. Most people do a lot better in their living rooms than they will ever do on the program. And our contestants react the same way. So they're in the audience and they're feeling confident. They say, gee, if I wish I had that game, boy, I'd have been able to make $15,000. And now all of a sudden it's their turn. So they realize nothing bad's going to happen. What they're concerned about most, and this is true, I would say, of 90% of the Jeopardy players, is not making a fool of themselves. Most of the time, our contestants are not there for the money on Jeopardy. They are there to show off their intellectual skills. They are there to have their moment in the sun and be television stars for that half hour.
You've been doing game shows for many years, and you hosted a lot of shows in Canada before even coming to America. You were the MC of a Stars on Ice variety show of championship horse racing and championship sports. How did you get into MCing and then game shows?
Let's see. I applied for a job as a summer announcer one year in order to raise some money to pay for my university. I got the job. I worked through the summer months. Around Christmas time, an opening came up on the permanent staff. They said, Alex, would you be interested in having this position? And I said, yes, if I can finish my senior year at college. And they said, go ahead. We'll have you working from 6 to midnight. You can attend school in the daytime. And I graduated and stayed with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Hosted a variety show at one time on which Alan Thicke and a friend of his appeared as a singing duet, And when Alan Thicke came to the United States to write for game shows, he suggested me as a possible host for a new show called Wizard of Odds that NBC was doing. I auditioned in New York for that. 2 weeks later, I came to Los Angeles, did the pilot. 2 weeks after that, the show went on the air, and the rest is, as they say, history. I've been doing it for the past 14 years.
Game shows have led to some interesting careers for some of the hosts. Johnny Carson got his start on, I think it was Who Do You Trust?
Mm-hmm.
And you Downs, I think, used to do Concentration.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Did you ever try to break out of game shows?
Well, I'm trying to do that now. I'm making an attempt to get into production more, and I may try to sneak back into acting a little bit, but I really don't have the time right now to do any of these things. I'm so busy with Jeopardy and Concentration and traveling around the country doing promotion for both of them and contestant searches that I have very little opportunity to indulge myself, if you will, in these other areas. But I'll make a move in that direction.
You know, there's a new ad campaign for the new season of Jeopardy, and I think it is showing you in a new image. The ad campaign is a few teenage girls sitting in a fast food restaurant playing Jeopardy with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then you walk in, and one of them says, "Ooh, I'd like to be in double Jeopardy with him." And I think your new image that they're promoting is as a real hunk, a real sexy guy. Is this something new for you, this image?
Well, it's a bit of a follow-up to the promos we have done for the past 2 years, in which I played kind of a James Bond character rescuing beautiful damsels in distress. And this year they didn't want me to rescue anybody, but they are mentioning or alluding to the fact that I am a hunk. And, hey, I like it. I don't have many more good years, so I might as well grab them while I can.
Well, thanks for talking with us, Alex.
My pleasure, Terry.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Alex Trebek is the host of Jeopardy! What is fresh air? You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are coming up?
Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman and also presidential hopeful Joseph Biden today laid out in detail all of his objections to Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork. We'll have a report on that. Also, a report on a suit filed earlier this week in federal court by several peace groups charging that nuclear weapons can be accidentally exploded, and that means missiles even being fired, by the electricity generated by very common things, CB radios, lightning, that sort of thing. We will also be speaking with Stuart Brand.
He created the Whole Earth Catalog, didn't he?
Yes, he sure did, and now he's written a book on reinventing the media.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's another Vietnam movie in theaters this week, Hamburger Hill. From the battlefront, in between the bullets and the bombs, this film addresses some of the social issues and movements of the time. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
I don't think anyone will call you a Philistine if you greet the news of yet another Vietnam film with a smothered yawn. Hamburger Hill is the fourth in the last year, and I'm not sure I want to see this become a new genre, like the detective movie or the space opera. Can't even pretend Hamburger Hill is a terrific film. It's often infuriatingly bad, and yet I don't for a minute regret seeing it. This is a combat movie, like a lot of the best war pictures that came out of World War II. It's about the taking of one hill in Vietnam during 10 bloody days of suicidal fighting. John Irvin, the director, was actually a documentary filmmaker who covered Vietnam. And what's extraordinary about the movie is its battle scenes. They reach a pitch of terrifying realism that only Platoon has begun to match. In Platoon, the combat sequences were about not being able to see what was coming, about young boys dying in the dark. But Hamburger Hill is about a world where you watch your death approach, where the grenades and the bullets come flying toward you with a terrible clarity that tells you everything without saving you. Unfortunately, Hamburger Hill also has a screenplay, and though the writer, Jim Karabatsos, is himself a Vietnam vet, that's no guarantee of his literary agility. The dialogue is painfully reminiscent of those cornball 40s bomber squad movies that featured one kid from every known ethnic group. Here's the usual scene where the grunt gets a Dear John letter from his girl.
Smells good, doesn't it?
What's for lunch?
Franks and beans, beanie weenies, spaghetti and bull's balls, more ham, Murphy's Law. I'm not eating it.
It's from my girlfriend. She says she's not gonna write anymore. Friends at college told her it was immoral to write to me. Oh.
You can hear in that clip how green some of the actors are. And since the movie is about, count 'em, 14 brave kids among the troops taking that hill, you're never really able to tell them apart, and hence, never really able to feel the emotion the movie is trying to sell you when disaster befalls them. Another thing that clip demonstrates is one of the movie's main themes, a theme the other Vietnam films don't address: how cruelly the peace movement back home treated these soldiers. Now, it's true that the hostility certain groups showed to troops who were as much the war's victims as anyone else was a truly unfortunate chapter in the history of the student left. On the other hand, this movie seems to be condemning the whole peace movement outright, and at the same time, showing us a Sisyphean battle to take a meaningless hill, at the top of which we find absolutely nothing. Hamburger Hill is at once morally strident and morally fuzzy. It wants to condemn the war and also condemn those who condemned it. Even so, it's well worth seeing. Not for the messages the screenplay is selling, but for the ones the movie's images so powerfully convey.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair.
Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. Hey, la da 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 da.
Here's what's coming up on the next Fresh Air. Next time, writer and publisher Barry Gifford will share his passion for crime novels like A Swell-Looking Babe and Forgive Me, Killer, books he describes as novels of existential American violence. Gifford is the founder of Black Lizard Books, which publishes old and new hard-boiled fiction. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, will share her passion for soap operas, and folk singer and guitarist Bill Staines will join us for our weekly performance spot. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant, additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.